to Sip for Speaks, the new podcast for all things public finance, brought to you by the Chartered Institute of Public Finance and Accountancy. I'm Ashley Moore and I will be your host for this episode. Thank you for tuning in to our first ever episode. We've got a bumper health and social care special lined up for you today, with speakers from the Institute for Government and the Health Foundation joining us later in the show. But first, to talk about the latest of the news, we have Vivian Russell, Head of Communications and Content at SIPFA and former editor of Public Finance Magazine, and David Williams, a senior policy advisor from NHS Providers, as well as a former journalist for Public Finance and the Health Service Journal. So it's a bit of a crazy time at the moment. The sands keep shifting underneath our feet. Obviously, we had the spending round fairly recently, where Boris made a few new announcements for funding for health and social care. I think some of the big figures were £1 billion for adult social care, £7 billion for NHS capital, although there's a lot of questions around about whether or not this is actually new money. So I thought I'd get some tapes from some former journalists on how we should be reading this.
It's interesting. I just think it's been sort of interesting how front and centre that the NHS always is in any debate about the public sector more broadly and public money, and it's seen that it's the kind of symbolic service. And I mean, I think we saw that a few weeks ago when Boris Johnson was ambushed by that guy at the Whips Cross Hospital, who really bawled him out about lack of funding for the NHS, you could say kind of unfairly, because Boris Johnson hasn't actually been in power all that long. And obviously that clip went viral on social media. And of course, if you sort of trace it back to the bus pledge on Brexit, it's like the two things are kind of in a weird sort of symbiosis. We will leave the European Union to free up money to invest in the NHS, which is a contentious and simplistic, controversial,
and it's really hung around, isn't it? I think Dominic Cummings said that if it hadn't been for the famous £350 million bus pledge, that they would not have won. And I think that has led to a couple of things. I think it has demonstrated to the Leave campaign and to the people on that campaign who are now in government the salience and the power of the NHS as an appeal to voters. I think it's also given them a very clear pledge that they are on the hook for, and not only have to be able to say they've delivered, they need to be able to demonstrate that they've delivered against that pledge. So there's loads of things that we just sort of talked about. I mean, one thing is, what's interesting is that arguably the bus pledge has already been answered.
It's by Theresa May's 10-year plan. Which she announced.
So what Theresa May announced in June last year and was followed through in the budget 2018 was attached to this long-term plan, which is a 10-year plan, and it came with a five-year funding settlement, which gives the NHS a real terms increase of £20.5 billion. So what that means is that if you take the baseline year of 18-19 and you adjust it for inflation across 5 years, and then you add on to it £20.5 billion, that's where the NHS revenue settlement is going to get to by 23-24. And that is a real terms increase of 3.4% a year, which is within roughly the territory that the NHS historically has had, although it's on the low side. There's a whole argument about, is there a Brexit dividend, which it's happily not my job to get into, and were we ever sending the EU £350 million a week anyway? I think most authorities on that say we never were, but even...
Well, yeah, the UK Statistics Authority thing had some things to say at the time about that, and that being a gross net contribution.
But even so, it has already been honoured. However, the claim doesn't seem to have gone away, and I think the new government seems to be recognising the importance of the NHS as a political priority and making it a political priority, and also is indicating that some more money will be on the way. And that probably brings us to the capital point.
And NHS Providers, is you have a capital campaign, don't you?
We do. So we're running a campaign. So what we need is, what we're asking for is three things on behalf of our membership. The first is that you need an adequate capital budget. The Health Foundation have done some excellent analysis on this, which in their failing to capitalise report, which I'd recommend to absolutely anybody, it's the best thing that anybody's written about capital.
And we'll be speaking with Anita Charlesworth from the Health Foundation later in the show.
Oh, brilliant. Okay, we'll ask her about it then. So their report, which came out earlier this year, is the best thing I've read on it. So what we need is a significant increase, probably a doubling in the amount of capital spending available to providers year on year. The second thing we need is we need certainty. So it's not okay to just have 1 year at a time capital budgets. We need a multi-year settlement. We always need to know roughly what capital is going to be available in 5 to 10 years. And then the third thing is we need a system that properly matches the need for capital investment with trust's ability to access it.
We've touched quite a lot there on the sort of capital pressures that are facing the NHS, but we touched briefly on the situation around Brexit. But funding for the NHS and for health and social care more widely has been something that's been a fairly hot topic for a long old while. while, particularly given the austerity agenda. So where does the kind of demand side of things fit into the picture that you're describing? Obviously demand is rising. There's talk about health and social care integration. How does that fit into the picture?
So demand is rising, and we can just expect it to continue to keep rising because of the demographic pressures that we face. I think one of the things that...
Well, they still haven't cracked the social care conundrum, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, although I think, again, Boris Johnson has said he will.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the role integration has to play as far as NHS funding is concerned?
Right, so it cannot be right that if somebody is a recipient of social care and those services don't join up properly with the NHS and they go to hospital avoidably, when it would have been possible for that admission to be prevented had they had access to the right care in the setting where they ordinarily live. That is a bad thing for patients, and it's therefore something that needs to be fixed. What the impact of getting all of that right would be, I think, is really, really hard to predict at scale, because it's the sort of thing that would happen over several years unless there is a massive shift to a preventative model of care that works. You can expect people to live longer with multiple long-term conditions. So demand for secondary care in the NHS is likely to keep on rising to some degree for the foreseeable future.
So my very inexpert view was always the kind of Victorian model of big buildings with lots of beds in them is kind of over, and we need to kind of decentralise services and be much more community-based, primary care, home-based, tech's going to come along.
I think what we're talking about really in terms of the preventative model is not... is how you deal with the expanding demand. The question isn't so much whether you can safely take that hospital out, It's how you provide for the increased demand. But there are going to always be people in winter who get pneumonia who are going to need to go to hospital. And most of the people who are in hospital right now are people who are critically ill.
The hospital isn't going anywhere. I suppose I was thinking that the more day surgery, the more elective surgery, you know, you can go in and out in a day. Maybe 10 years ago or 20 years ago, you would have spent a week in hospital.
Okay, I think we are running short on time. So thank you both for your time today. And thank you for joining us on Sip the Speaks. That was Vivian Russell and David Williams on the latest in health news. Up next, we have Graham Atkins from the Institute for Government. Hello, Graham.
Hello.
So for any of our listeners who may not have heard of the Institute for Government, although I'd be surprised if they hadn't, can you tell us a bit about the IFG and what you guys do?
Yeah, so the Institute for Government is an independent think tank. We are dedicated to trying to make government more effective. So regardless of what policies a government wants to pursue, our mission is to try and advise them on how they can do that well. And so the work we do that's relevant here is an annual report called Performance Tracker, where we track how much money the government is spending on different public services, and how well they're performing, i.e. what the public is getting for the money that they're investing.
The Performance Tracker is something that the Institute for Government work on in partnership with SIPFA, and Nick Davies is going to be attending a couple of our conferences in the very near future. I believe he's speaking at both our Health and Social Care conference on the 30th of October and our Central Government conference later on in November. So we thought we'd take this opportunity to have a bit of a chat with Graham about the Performance Tracker, specifically in relation to the health and social care side of things. What would you say were last year's headlines for health and social care as far as the Performance Tracker is concerned?
So I think the headlines for health and social care really differ depending on which service you're looking at. So if I start with one of the rosier pictures, if we look at how general practice in England is performing, you can kind of see there's been a spending uptick over the last 5 years. And actually there are some signs that general practitioners have become more efficient. So we know that they're using more telephone and online consultations. That's really helped them to meet rising demand. On the other hand, there are still some pressures in terms of waiting times. So you are now less likely than you were in 2009-10 to be able to get an appointment the next day. And that really relates to the other major pressures on hospitals, where you've seen kind of again spending increase quite rapidly, but not as quickly as the number of people turning up at A&E and for other regular outpatient appointments, which has meant that although spending has increased, people are still kind of waiting longer once they get to A&E. And really continuing down that line, the service really under the most pressure is adult social care. So even to maintain the system as it is, that is to say, keeping the same means and needs tests that are in place to receive publicly funded social care, any government would have to put additional money in unless adult social care can become vastly more efficient, which looks very unlikely given the really evident pressures on the care providers and on local authorities as well.
Okay, so the next edition of the performance tracker is hurtling towards us at some pace. Can you give us a little bit of a kind of teaser of what's to come? Is performance getting better or worse?
I think sadly, performance is not really getting better, at least on those key metrics of waiting times in hospitals and in general practice. You've seen the same scale of decline over the last year. And I think one thing that's really notable, if you look at A&E performance, it has a very seasonal pattern. Performance declines a lot in the winter when lots of people turn up, and then it tends to kind of recover a bit in the summer, and then you see annual spikes and falls. What's been really notable is this summer, there's really been no recovery in performance, which implies that there's been kind of really significant pressure in hospitals, possibly due to the hot weather, for example. The really new notable thing is that this year, we're not just looking at how performance has changed, but how performance is likely to change in the future, given what we already know about how much money the government is committing to different public services. We already know that NHS England is going to get quite a large spending boost, and we've looked at how much of that we think is going to go to general practice, how much is going to go to acute hospitals and other services, and kind of the key conclusion I take away from that is that this new money is probably roughly enough to meet demand, that is to say, to treat the increasing number of people turning up for a general practice consultation or at a hospital, but it's unlikely to be enough to kind of achieve the expansion of services that the government outlined in the NHS long-term plan. So really, fundamentally, there's a trade-off. Either the government needs to allocate more money or find a way to make these services more efficient, or kind of be upfront about the fact that some of these improvements that it's promised are probably not going to be viable.
Touching on both the fact that you pointed out the increase in funding for the NHS and this idea of whether or not the government needs to be more upfront about its spending pledges. Obviously, in the recent spending round, Boris Johnson announced a few sort of funding windfalls for social care. He made large-scale announcements when he first took office that he was going to fix social care. Is this funding enough? Are those pledges realistic?
On social care, there's kind of two things I'll split. So the new money announced at the spending round, there's a question of whether is that enough to keep things as they are, or will access to publicly funded social care, you know, continue to decline in the same way it has after 2010. I think the money allocated are probably roughly enough to keep things where they are. The overall amount of money allocated to social care, government said, was increasing by 1.5 billion, but actually 500 million of that will be raised for the council tax precept. This is not a government grant, this is the government allowing councils to raise council tax to spend on social care for at least a third of that money. I think there's a question about whether they will have to keep doing that in the future, given both parties are now committed also to raising the national living wage, which both announced at the conferences, which will raise the cost of providing care, because we know a lot of care workers are currently paid the national minimum wage, and it'll be very difficult for independent providers to absorb that cost without passing it on to local authorities. I think the other side of the question is, does the government really have any serious plans to reform adult social care, to expand access, to make certain services like free personal care free at the point of use rather than means tested? The answer is it might do, but it has not shared them. So I think probably the money announced is enough to keep us where we are, but we really are no further forward.
It's quite interesting you talk about how the money is enough to keep us where we are, and then maybe how that intersects with what you say the performance tracker is likely to indicate, that where they are isn't fantastic as far as performance is concerned. Not the greatest picture all round.
No, and I think in fairness, this is a difficulty any future government really will have to deal with. Over the medium term, we know that there's going to be a lot of financial pressures coming from the fact that we have an ageing population who are living longer, but also we know that people with learning and physical disabilities are living longer as well, thanks to advances in medical technology, which is all fantastic news, but it does mean that we're probably going to have to increase spending on health, social care and pensions to kind of continue to provide the same level of service as we are now. And that long-term fiscal pressure is going to be something any government is going to have to deal with. Even if you're increasing spending, you're really just going to be keeping things where they are.
So interestingly, based on what you touched on there, the biggest issue is demand. What are your thoughts on the demand issue? What are the main obstacles to overcoming that?
The demand issue is really two things. There's a question about whether government wants to increase spending just to meet demand, and there's a question about whether there are certain demands which are effectively preventable or treatable at a lower cost at an earlier stage. I think on the first question, how much money does it want to spend and how it will raise that. And the second one is a question of how much we invest in wider preventative services and what the evidence is that these can actually be effective. We know that Nuffield Trust, a health think tank, estimates that by greater use of NHS 111, we've managed to divert a number of people who would otherwise have ended up in accident and emergency to general practice. Likewise, there seems to be some evidence that increasing access to social care can help reduce accident and emergency admissions. But there's a bigger question, at least in the studies that I've seen, about whether that's cost effective. A full social care package can be quite expensive, whereas perversely, turning up to accident and emergency can be relatively cheap for the public sector to respond to. So I think ultimately, if the government wants to kind of seriously find ways to reduce demand, it means not only to invest in it, but to invest seriously in evaluation of which schemes work, so they have a better idea of how to share what works between different areas.
Do you think integration has any role to play in that? You've touched briefly on prevention.
Again, I think actually the questions for integration are very similar to the questions for prevention. So I think the problems to having a more integrated service are quite well rehearsed, from difficulties aligning budgets to getting stakeholders from local government and the NHS in the room to agree, working out who the savings actually flow to and therefore where the money should go. I think one of the things, again, we lack is really a good idea of a good theory of change as to why integration would help save money. And again, this might just be a case of an area where it would be really worthwhile for the government to invest in a few targeted pilots, but it would be very difficult, I think, when one of the big objections to running pilots, whether they be of integrated care or preventative services, are really that we're effectively running a natural experiment and people are very uncomfortable about the idea that services can vary from one part of the country to another.
Yeah, it's the question mark over the fairness of effectively human guinea pigs for government piloting, for lack of a better phrase.
And that's one way of describing it.
Okay, so we're running out of time. So to conclude, what would you say your key messages are, or the Institute for Government's key messages are for government as far as health and social care funding and health and social care performance are concerned, particularly in light of the upcoming performance tracker?
I think there are three things I'd pull out. It's kind of key things that government should know and be aware of but be tackling. The first is they need to be absolutely upfront about what people can expect from services, given the level of spending they want to allocate. The second is really that social care has been the Cinderella of the health and social care sector, well, not just since 2010, but you know, arguably since 1945. But really, the significant decline in performance since 2010 about all social care and the fact that we cut spending on social care while increasing spending on the NHS really means that this needs to be a focus for the next government to outline exactly what they expect the social care system to do, how they're going to structure it, and how they're going to fund it. And the third thing I think I'll point out is that over the next 20 years or so, demand is going to be the biggest problem facing any government. And we need to think now about how we invest in prevention and what works sensibly. One of the most useful things any government could do now would be really to invest in the evaluation of these schemes.
Thank you very much for your time today, Graham, and we'll look forward to seeing your colleague Nick at our upcoming conferences. You've been listening to Sip for Speaks. That was Graham Atkins from the Institute for Government. Nick Davis from the Institute for Government will be speaking more about the performance tracker at SIPFA's upcoming Health and Social Care Conference, Insights into Integration, on the 30th of October. Up next, we have Anita Charlesworth from the Health Foundation. Hello, Anita.
Hi.
So, would you care to tell our listeners a little bit about the Health Foundation?
The Health Foundation is an endowed charity, and we work to improve the quality and effectiveness of health and healthcare across the UK. And we do that by funding grants, particularly in the NHS, but increasingly also thinking about local government, for people who are trying to implement practical programmes to improve care. We fund research in universities, and we also undertake research and policy analysis ourselves. And in that latter function, you might think of us as a think tank, sort of similar to the Nuffield Trust or the King's Fund.
So a pretty broad remit there, Anita. Anita is joining SIPFA at our Health and Social Care Conference on the 30th of October. For many, many, many people, social care is one of those things that brings to mind images of the elderly or of looked after children. And from what you've said, it's much, much, much broader than this. Boris Johnson has recently made huge promises that he's going to go out there and he's going to fix social care. It's a big problem. How realistic is that promise, really?
Well, what he's done so far is done what governments have done for several years now, is kind of looked over the precipice and said, oh my goodness, this is really tight. There's going to be a big problem next year if we don't do something about it, and put in some short-term sticking plaster funding. Now, that's better than not putting the sticking plaster funding in. And the announcement in the spending review, well, the Chancellor said it'd be £1.5 billion for social care next year. There's £1 billion coming from central government grant. That'll go for both adult social care and children's social care. And the government has said it expects it to be split half and half, broadly speaking. So adult social care is due to get £500 million more in grant next year. In addition to that, they confirmed that some one-off funding would also continue, and that's winter pressures grant and social care support grant and the Better Care Fund. They're not being increased but in line with inflation, but they're not being taken away. And then they fell back on the precept and said that local authorities can levy another year of precept at 2%. And if every local authority does that, that would deliver another £500 million. And our estimates are that funding injection for next year is just about enough to stop things getting worse. If they're going to think about a solution, and we're now promised a white paper. There was talk of it coming before the party conference, but you know, we've been here before with it being promised imminently and then not appearing. But really, I think in any white paper, he's going to have to address three really big pressures. One is the degree of unmet need, making sure that in the future, funding continues to grow in line with need. The second is recognising the cost pressures from pay, and if it's going to be harder to recruit internationally in a post-Brexit world, and domestic labour is more and more in demand and we're in full employment, and governments rightly want to make sure that people don't work on poverty pay and have decent terms and conditions. Pay, and also wider cost pressures for providers, where Competition and Markets Authority did a study, a sector was saying the average amount per person that's paid by local authorities is below the cost of providing decent quality of care. Putting right those issues is expensive. It's also technically quite complicated to think, how do you get the money to the right place, given the nature of a very fragmented sector? And then the third question, which is the question that obviously is much in people's minds, is the fairness of the balance of responsibility for the individual and the state, and should people's assets, and most importantly their housing assets, be taken into account. And there are kind of two really credible policy options in the mix at the moment, which is the reforms that were proposed by Sir Andrew Dilnot's commission back in 2011 and are in fact the law of the land. So they were part of the Care Act. Other people have been arguing, most obviously and recently now the Labour Party, to move to a system more like the Scottish free personal care system. And again, the Dilnot approach, if you start with a high cap, that's the cheapest of the options. If you want to go to something more like Scottish model, that's many billions more. So his challenge is, does he try and solve all of these problems? In which case, you've got a very, very big bill, definitely upwards of £10 billion. Or does he try to pick one of those? And one thing you might think, well, is, oh, let's do the reform to the funding, because that's one of the things that people find most egregious in the system. It's not fair that individuals have to contribute to social care and not to healthcare. And of course, that was labelled the dementia tax. The trouble is, could you argue to people that they're going to pay a lot more towards social care, which they would through either the tax system or special levy or national insurance, however you want to do this, but that's for a social care system that is fundamentally not going to give people who they would think, you know, have a right to the care access, because that's restricted with a very, very high needs test at the moment. Or if they do get through that hurdle and they're eligible, actually the quality of care isn't good. That's a very hard sales pitch, isn't it? And if you think about this as an insurance, it's like, say, pay more to insure your house. We've excluded most of the things that might happen to your house. And if you do need to claim, it'll be a really shoddy service. I mean, that's not a sellable proposition. So actually, the challenge in this is not so much that each individual area reform is insurmountable. It is that actually if you don't do it as a package, it almost certainly won't be successful and sustainable, but the package is very expensive.
Well, there's a lot to unpack there, and the Prime Minister certainly has a challenge on his hands when it comes around to launching that white paper. Mm. But as far as what we see with respect to social care in the news, one of the biggest issues is the sort of interplay between the health sector and the social care sector. We hear a lot about bed blocking and the fact that if there was more capacity within social care, the NHS would have its pressures relieved. How do we break down kind of the silos between health and social care to create a more integrated, place-based system?
Integration of health and social care, by which I mean for the person and their family in receipt of care, it feels like as seamless a system as we can possibly make it, is really, really important. But I think it's really, really important in the way I just framed it, for the quality of experience of people who need a range of support, both classic healthcare support and social care support. What I think is wrong is to suggest that the reason why we should be reforming social care is essentially to relieve a cost pressure on the NHS. When you come back to the Care Act and the recognition that social care is not there simply to help the NHS, it is the starting point for social care is to support people to live independent and fulfilling lives. And many of their social care needs won't have a healthcare consequence. And so we mustn't make the social care, skew the social care system away from the focus on the individual needs towards thinking about what does the healthcare system need. What's really important, I think, is that in all the focus on integration, that the prism through which we look at integration is the individual service user. What that means, I think, is that also what we've done so far in a lot of cases is focus on things like budgetary integration or governance integration. And actually, there is some research evidence that that can help integration because it stops some things getting in the way. But there's very little evidence that budgetary integration is the right way to get service integration. And I would argue that if we're serious about service integration, thinking a lot more about the workforce, communications, IT system integration, those sorts of things are going to be much more important than budgetary integration.
So just to summarise, I suppose, and thank you very much for your time today, what would you say are your sort of key messages for government as far as social care funding is concerned? Maybe if we can wrap it up into about three statements.
I think this is social care's time. I think the public really see the injustice of social care and want reform. And there's more appetite now for holistic and wholesale reform than I can remember in my career. But if you are going to reform, it needs to be holistic reform, which thinks not only about the balance of funding between individual and the state, but the quality of care, the access to care, and also the ability of the social care workforce to be trained and equipped to deliver the good quality care that they want to.
Thank you very much for your time today, Anita.
Anita will also be joining us at our Health and Social Care Conference at the end of the month. That about wraps us up for this episode. Thank you to all of our speakers for joining us for our inaugural episode, and we look forward to bringing you more from the world of public finance very soon.